Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're here to, cut through the noise and really get to the heart of what matters. And today, we're tackling a huge question. It's something that affects almost everything, but we rarely stop to define it properly. How do we really understand value? Especially in a world just swimming in information and frankly conflicting ideas. Our focus for this deep dive is a really profound philosophical framework. It's John McMurtry's Life Value, Onto Axiology. Now, I know that's a bit of a mouthful. Onto, that's about being, existence. Axiology, the study of value. So essentially, it's a theory that anchors value directly in life itself, in our existence, not just, abstract concepts or market whims. And it's significant. Really significant. Scholars like Martin Gran and Edward H. Wibbins called it, and I'm quoting here, in all probability, the most articulate theory of value developed by any philosopher in the 21st century.
That's incredibly high praise, and, well, it's deserved. This isn't just philosophy for its own sake, you see. It's a very rigorously developed framework. It's designed to help us grasp the real, the true, and the good across, well, everything. All aspects of life. And what's really compelling, I think, is its practical focus. It's about how we can create what McMurtry calls a life-coherent economy. An economy that's genuinely built around fundamental human needs, around life flourishing. It's about valuing life, truly.
Exactly. So our mission today is to unpack the core logic here, explore its universal principles, and really see how it just challenges our usual ways of thinking about value, economy, even progress.
Yeah.
Think of this as your shortcut to getting informed on a really important, potentially world-changing idea. Okay, let's unpack this, starting right at the foundation. So the absolute bedrock of McMurtry's theory, it's called the primary axiom of all value. And it's quite elegant, really, but powerful. It goes like this. X is value if and only if, and to the extent that, X consists in or enables a more coherently inclusive range of thought, feeling, and action than without it.
Mm-hmm. And you really need the flip side to get the full picture, the converse. So X is value if and only if, and to the extent that, X reduces, disables, or destroys any range of thought, experience, or action. That immediate opposition, that inverse, it gives you a really clear line. Value versus harm. It's like a compass, isn't it? Pointing towards life flourishing or away from it.
Right. So this thought, feeling, and action bit the TFA components. Can you break those down a little? What do they actually look like in practice? How do they work together?
Sure. So thought, the T, that's our internal world, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Images, concepts, how we understand things intellectually, learning, reasoning, imagining that capacity. Then F, the felt side of being, that senses, desires, emotions, moods, our whole experiential dimension, joy, connection, physical well-being, and action. A, that's animate movement, doing things, not just humans, but across species, organizations too. The capacity to engage, to create, to move. And here's where it gets really interesting. McMurtry connects these to the goodwill. That's not just some vague moral idea. It's when thought, feeling, and action work together as one to achieve the goal of the primary axiom enabling more life range.
Ah, okay. So TFA working in harmony for life.
Precisely. And the true. That's defined as progressive consistency with this axiom, with life coherence. So something is true if it consistently expands that collective range of thought, feeling, and action.
Yeah.
He even uses symbols like a formula plus VLR and BVLR, where L is the range of TFA, just to show its logical precision. But yeah, the simplest takeaway for us, more life range equals value. Less life range equals disvalue. It takes something often seen as subjective and makes it, well, remarkably precise.
Incredibly precise, yeah. It sounds almost like a universal formula, but such a huge claim, an unshakable objective axiom for all value. You can imagine some listeners thinking, really, across all cultures, all times, how does McMurtry address that? How robust is this claim? Because here's where it gets really interesting.
That's the critical point, absolutely. And McMurtry does tackle it head on. The strength of the P axiom, its validity, rests on 9 specific points. But let's touch on a few key ones. First, it's self-evident. Just try to deny it, seriously.
Yeah.
Argue that reducing thought or feeling or the capacity for action is good.
Right, it falls apart immediately.
Exactly, it becomes nonsensical. There's no logical ground to stand on to argue against expanding life capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Second, it's universality. There isn't really a domain of value judgment where it doesn't apply. Personal ethics, science, art, economics, it's foundational. Third, it's objectivity. This is crucial. The value it defines exists whether anyone recognizes it or not. It's not opinion. It's about the actual effect. Does something enable or disable life range? Think about, say, clean air. Its value for life isn't up for debate, right? It objectively enables us to live.
Makes sense.
Fourth, sovereignty. If you have conflicting values, this axiom takes precedence. Why? Because it's the most fundamental measure of what supports life itself. If another value undermines that, the axiom overrides it. And finally, measurability. This isn't just abstract talk. We can actually assess greater or lesser ranges of thought, felt, being, and action in any given situation.
Yeah.
It allows for tangible evaluation, not just theory.
That's quite a foundation, an objective lens for value. So, okay, if we take this powerful axiom as our starting point, what does it mean for how we actually build things, like society, an economy? How do we move from this principle to making sure human flourishing isn't just a nice idea, but like the core design?
Exactly the right question. And that's where McMurtry introduces the universal human life necessities and principles of their provision. It's essentially a blueprint for a life coherent world. Principle one sets the stage. The ultimate organizing principle, the absolute priority for any life coherent society or economy, has to be secure access for everyone to the means of life, to life goods, across generations. This means producing and distributing essentials, protecting ecosystems. These are paramount. And the converse. If a system doesn't do this, if it actively deprives people of these necessities, it's not just failing, it's fundamentally flawed, working against life.
Okay, that seems clear. But let's pin down means of life. What exactly falls under that umbrella according to this framework? Can you give us a clear definition?
Principle two defines it very clearly. A means of life is anything that enables life capacities or abilities that wouldn't be possible without it. Think basic needs. Clean water, food that actually nourishes, shelter, basic education like literacy. These aren't optional extras. They unlock fundamental human capabilities.
Right. The building blocks.
Precisely. And just as important is the converse. Things claimed as goods that disable or simply don't enable life capacities. McMurtry mentions junk commodities, addictive products. They are definitively not means of life. They might make money, sure. They might be traded. But they don't add to life coherence. Often, they actually subtract from it.
And McMurtry doesn't just leave it there, does he? Principle three lays out a whole set, a complete universal list of these means of life. It's like a checklist for human flourishing. It covers everything from the absolute basics, atmospheric needs like breathable air, sense open space, light, bodily needs, water, food, sanitation, a secure home. But it goes way beyond that, into the environmental surroundings, how they contribute. Crucially, caring, love, social inclusion, safety, healthcare. Then educational and recreational needs, language, art, play, learning. Vocational needs, having meaningful work or service. And finally, social justice, ensuring everyone has self-governing choice in enjoying these things, consistent with everyone else having them too. It's incredibly comprehensive.
It is. And what's really provocative, maybe even more so, is the flip side he draws from this. He argues that any priced commodity that isn't, directly or indirectly, providing these fundamental means of life, it's uneconomic.
Uneconomic.
Yes, or even anti-economic if it wastes resources that could have gone towards real life needs. Think about those non-growth addictive commodities again.
Yeah.
They might generate huge market figures, but from this life value perspective, they're a drain. They pull resources away from providing actual means of life. It forces a radical rethink of what we usually call economic activity.
Wow, yeah. That completely reframes how we measure success, doesn't it? We're so used to GDP, economic growth figures, but this suggests a totally different yardstick. It's not just a tweak. It's like turning the whole thing upside down.
It absolutely is. Principle four follows directly. The real measure is the provision or deprivation of these means of life. And it's measurable. We can look at greater or lesser sufficiency. We can quantify access to clean water. We can measure living space per person. We can track the hours of work genuinely contributing to others' well-being. It's not fuzzy. It's about real, tangible conditions.
And the contrast, he points out, is so stark. The converse of that principle. Just because someone is willing or able to pay a price for something, well, that doesn't measure its life requirement at all. Often, he says, it's the opposite. Think about fast food, huge market, often low price, but minimal life value nutritionally.
Oh, right.
Or massive fuel-guzzling leisure vehicles. The market price is often completely detached from real life value.
Precisely. Which leads straight into principle five. The true measure of how a society or economy is doing overall isn't GDP growth per se, it's civil commons development. That means universal access for everyone to these essential life goods, including a fair share of the work needed to provide them. So instead of just tallying up commodities sold, we should be measuring things like nutritional intake levels, clean water access, environmental biodiversity, literacy rates going up or down, life expectancy trends, participation in meaningful work, access to art, Play.
Those are the real vital signs.
Exactly. Yeah. Those are the indicators of a genuinely flourishing society.
That's such a departure from standard metrics. The source even emphasizes the converse, right? That GDP growth is basically not accurate, not reliable, unless it clearly tracks with improved access to these life goods for everyone. And it is examples of where this does happen, things like universal healthcare, publicly funded higher education, libraries, parks, playgrounds, things not primarily driven by private profit or market demand.
Right. Systems designed, consciously or not, around a more life-coherent model.
Okay, so if we're rethinking measurement and what's truly economic, then we must also need to rethink capital, right? What counts as real capital in this life value world? It feels very different from just financial capital.
Definitely. This brings us to Principle 6 and the idea of life capital LC. McMurtry defines this as the primary capital of any society or economy. What is it? It's the wealth of means of life and life goods that can actually produce more life goods over time, without being depleted, often even growing if managed well. Think of healthy ecosystems, forests, oceans, soil, that's ecological capital. Think of strong communities, trust, cooperation, that's social capital. Think of shared knowledge, skills, culture, that's knowledge capital. These are assets that are fundamentally regenerative.
Regenerative, okay. They build on themselves.
Yes, if not actively destroyed. And again, the converse is just as important. Anything claimed as capital that doesn't directly or indirectly produce means of life through time. That's false capital. It's seen as inefficient because it pulls resources toward its own expansion, often at the expense of life needs.
Can you give examples of that false capital?
Sure. Think about money capital growing through, say, manufacturing non-defensive weapons. That product doesn't enable life. It often destroys it. Or purely financial speculation, like on currencies. It might create huge money returns for some, but does it build houses, grow food, educate people?
Not directly, no.
Right. From this lens, it's often a diversion of resources and intelligence away from producing tangible life goods. Or think about industries built on producing life-disabling commodities, say, heavily processed foods linked to chronic disease. That's not just unproductive in life terms, it's actively destructive.
That definition of false capital, yeah, it's pretty confronting when you start applying it to our current economy. Okay, so if that's real capital, what about real efficiency? We talk about efficiency all the time in business, but I bet this framework redefines that too.
It absolutely does. Principle 7 breaks down efficiency into three types, all focused on enabling life goods, not just maximizing money returns. First, ecological efficiency. This isn't just about pollution control. It's about inputs and throughputs working together to provide life goods while diminishing waste and negative side effects. Think truly circular economies or farming that actually builds soil health, life-supporting processes.
Okay, ecological efficiency. What's next?
Second, physical input-output efficiency. This is classic doing more with less, but specifically for life goods. Reducing the amount of materials, energy, space, or mandatory work time needed to produce the same or greater output of means of life. Simple things like, you know, a well-designed tool or a cooperative work structure that gets the job done better with less drudgery. Smart ways to meet needs.
Right. Getting more life value from less input.
Exactly. And third, human development efficiency. This is about developing people's capabilities through education, healthcare, meaningful work. When people are healthier, better educated, more skilled, engaged, they can create more life goods, have more choices, more lifetime. Investing in people is efficient from this perspective.
So the really powerful conclusion here, the converse that flips everything, is that if higher money profit margins don't lead to greater ecological input or human development efficiency, they aren't just inefficient, they are actually diseconomic. Things like huge CEO payouts gained by firing workers, cutting environmental safety, dodging taxes while demanding public assets be privatized. This framework sees that as fundamentally wasteful, as destroying life capital. It really makes you look at the headlines completely differently, doesn't it? Wow, what a fascinating and challenging deep dive this has been. John McMurtry's Life Value onto Axiology, it really does offer this incredibly robust, objective way to understand value. And from there, a potential blueprint for structuring society, the economy, around what genuinely supports life. It pushes us way beyond the usual metrics, forces a reevaluation of, well, almost everything. This is serious food for thought.
It really is. And maybe the key takeaway, the question to leave you, the listener, with is this. If we started consistently applying this life value lens, really applying it, what would we need to change? What parts of our daily lives, our consumption habits, our societal priorities would need a fundamental reevaluation? What happens if life value, not money value, becomes the real measure of success?
That's a powerful question to ponder. Thank you so much for joining us on the Deep Dive. We really hope you'll keep exploring these critical ideas and thinking about what it means to build a world and live a life that is truly valuable.